The next case, number 22-1918, United States versus Alejandro Cortez Lopez. At this time, would counsel for the appellant introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Fernando Perez and I represent the appellant Alejandro Cortez Lopez. May I please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Cortez, when he pled guilty, he sacrificed his constitutional rights for a promise made by the United States that it would stand with him in a united front at the time of sentencing to recommend a sentence of probation. Not only did the plea agreement recommend a sentence of probation, it further set the offense level at 18 and contemplated no other enhancements. However, at the time that sentencing arrived, the united front collapsed, if there even was a united front. And we see two breaching acts in this record, the first one being the prosecutorial endorsement of a higher offense level than the parties had contemplated. And secondly, government attorney's not an ability, but rather not supplying the court with its reasons, and thereby withholding a material recommendation for a sentence of non-imprisonment.
Well, the defendant objected to the PSR, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so what the government did was to say, we agree that the probation correctly calculated the PSR.
Well, that is part of what the government did.
Let's take that piece.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I said, let's just take that piece. I know we have a different argument on something else, but on that particular piece, the government said that it agreed with the calculation, with the enhancement. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
So is it the defendant's position that the government should have just stood silent when it was a contest over the enhancements? I'm just trying to figure out what you think the government should. Given the dual role of the government, what do you think in that particular moment the government should have done?
Well, I think that one thing that sets this case apart from a lot of the cases that we see in the case law is the fact that there was no judicial inquiry made to this government attorney. It was simply, so this wasn't a preliminary statement either. The government attorney at the sentencing hearing simply wanted to remind the court that there were pending objections that hadn't been ruled upon, it could have simply done that and stopped right there. Instead, what we see is the prosecutor making the statement that it agrees with probation's calculations, and the effect is practically devastating. And this is despite the fact that the recommendation for a sentence of probation was done regardless of criminal history category, regardless of the offense level. But it still does damage to the plea in that the—
Wait a minute. So if the prosecutor has simply said there are pending objections and the court then said, well, what is the government's position on the correctness of the enhancement calculations, you would not be here arguing that that would be a breach.
I think it would depend on what transpired right after. I do believe that if there was still no substantive recommendation for the agreed to sentence of probation, then there's still an issue of breach there.
Counsel, would it be acceptable for the government, in your view, to respond to the probation position by saying, we agree, we have no disagreement with the probation officer's factual statements? Would that be permissible?
I think it would be a different case, but again,
it is a different case. That's why I'm asking.
Right, right. But I do think it's missing a second component, which is explaining the reasons for this sentence of probation.
Right, agreed, but to respond to Judge Thompson's question, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is the government could address facts and could also say, and Judge, here's why we stand by our recommendation of probation, regardless of what you do with this guideline. Yes, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I do believe that referring to the facts of this, it was imperative here that the government provide some context, because merely telling the court that this offense levels that's four levels higher than the parties had contemplated is...
This is on Lawson, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It's linked to Lawson, and that's the point that I wanted to get to. And so what the government is doing is it's turning its back on the representations that the government's version of facts, which stipulated to an amount, a loss amount of $749,000, give or take, and then endorsing this higher offense level that says, no, it wasn't just for about $750,000, it's really upwards of $5 million.
Well, the government's brief says that probation asked the government about the loss amount, and that the government responded appropriately, it says, by giving the correct amount of loss it deemed was effectuated. So they're saying that they answered a question asked of them.
So I'm not privy to any communications between the government and the PSR writer, but and again, this is where the context comes in. Because loss amount, it isn't a very specific or particular enhancement. This isn't whether there's one gun, two guns, seven guns, and then the offense level goes up. It's a very amorphous standard for determining loss amount, and so I think that when you have a custom plea, as we do here, and we have the government saying, no, your culpability...
Well, it's not amorphous. I mean, there's a way to reasonably calculate what the loss amount is. I mean, if probation has to do it, whether you think it's amorphous or not.
And the reason I use amorphous, Your Honor, is there's different considerations. If you look at the PSR in this case, it does appear that some of the victim statements, that there may have been some incomplete submissions. I know that there were upwards of 200 victims in this case, but only about 60 or so submitted these victim statements and forms. And so for that reason, and that takes me to my second point, I believe, it was imperative that the government explain its view of the case to the court.
Counsel, I think one of the things we may all be asking is your argument that does your argument depend on both parts of both that the government says to the court that it agrees with the loss enhancement calculation by probation, and then that it doesn't explain the reason why it recommended a probation sentence nevertheless? If you didn't have both things, so if they had said they agreed with the loss calculations and then went on and said, but the reason we have stipulated to $750,000 in the plea agreement, and we think that's correct based on the sentencing factors is X, would you still be here?
I do think that we're raising two discrete breach claims, so yes, even though they synergize, and we are raising each one independently.
Can I ask you a couple of quick questions? I hope they're quick, but
yes.
One, is there any basis that you're complaining at least a little bit about the government's treatment of the victims who testified in the sentencing? As I understand the law, they are entitled to do so. The government has an obligation to help them do so. Do you agree with that?
Oh, certainly, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that's
I assume there can't be a problem with the government simply providing information to the probation office, whether requested or not.
In general, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then on this critical point about a failure of advocacy, did you want to address this court's Brown decision and Lessard, particularly if we're here on plain error review? Part of my problem is just how plain is the error when you've got First Circuit case law saying the government is not necessarily required to offer ruffles and flourishes with its recommendation and doesn't have to be particularly enthusiastic about it.
So if I could just start
please.
With that point. I believe that case involved it wasn't a joint sentencing recommendation in that case. It may have been a split recommendation. And so when you look at the language that Your Honor just quoted, I believe it comes immediately after saying the defense could seek a low end and the government could seek a high end. And so the government wasn't required to pull any punches. But that situation is different from one.
Not pulling punches, no. But the question is whether there's an obligation to advocate when an implied obligation to advocate.
I do think so, Your Honor, and we see that in this court's case law that says that the government cannot provide mere lip service. It has to deliver an
That's why I'm asking you to please address Lazar.
Right, so Lazar, if I'm remembering correctly, is the case where the government asked for a big sentence, I believe were the words that were used there. And so context clarified that it wasn't that it wasn't trying to breach, it was simply trying to keep the court from going below the guideline range based on arguments submitted by the defense. And then Brown, like I said, is a split recommendation case.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, counsel for the United States can please introduce themselves to begin.
May it please the court, Maria Doctor for the government. The court should affirm Mr. Cortez's sentence because he's failed to show on the plain error review or otherwise that the prosecutor breached the plea agreement in this case. First, at the outset, the proper review here is for plain error. And Mr. Cortez has failed to show that the prosecutor's performance was erroneous, let alone on a plain error review. First, to address the government's preliminary statements at the sentencing hearing, a context matters here. Here, there were pending formal objections before the district court. The PSR brought up a different guideline calculation than the parties had agreed upon in the plea agreement. And then Mr. Cortez objected to these calculations, and the probation officer responded. And Mr. Cortez himself, at the sentencing hearing, did not flag his pending formal objections. So the government stood up and stated, before we make our argument, I would like to flag to the court that there are pending formal objections, and that the probation officer has responded, and the government believes the probation officer's assessment of those enhancements is correct.
How is that consistent with the plea agreement to use offense level 18?
The government had a duty to resolve this pending formal objection before the district court, and the government.
I'm sorry. I appreciate that the prosecutor brought the question to the court's attention. But raising the issue and then endorsing the higher guideline calculation is difficult for me to square with the plea.
The government never advocated for the higher guideline calculation here.
It endorsed the probation officer's conclusion, correct?
The government merely noted that the facts supported the probation officer's calculation.
That sounds like an endorsement of the enhancement. If I were the district judge and the government said, we agree that the facts support this enhancement, that sure sounds to me like the government thinks the enhancement applies, as opposed to taking just a neutral stance.
The government was responding to the formal objections and the probation officer's view of the case, simply notifying that the facts supported what the probation officer had calculated, contrary to any indication made by Mr. Cortez in his objection. And this court's case law states that supporting an enhancement entails an element of advocacy. And there was no such advocacy in this case, and that was stated in Armando Nunez in this case.
This is what the prosecutor said. The United States believes the U.S. probation office is correct in their assessment of those enhancements. That certainly seems like an endorsement to me.
The prosecutor here noted that the facts supported what the probation officer had calculated, in contravention to any indication by Mr. Cortez by objecting to those enhancements. And that was, and I would point this forward to United States v. Gall, where a substantially similar statement was made by the prosecutor, and thereafter, right away, in the spirit of the plea agreement, telling the court that, in U.S. v. Gall, telling the court that the government stood by the plea agreement and then recommended the sentence as the parties had agreed upon the plea agreement. And that is precisely what happened in this case. The government noted and believed that the facts were correct as per probation officer's recognition, but then unequivocally went on to state that it was recommending a 24-month probationary sentence, which is what it would which is what the covenant obligation was under the terms of the plea agreement.
But counsel, you're asking us to look at the context, and that's really what I'm concerned about here, because the government actually agreed to a substantial downward variance here, just probation, no prison time at all. And it stands up and unprompted says, and that was driven largely by the loss calculation, and the plea agreement says the government has looked at the sentencing factors, decided $750,000 or $749,000 is the correct loss amount. But then at the sentencing hearing, the first thing it says is probation's assessment of the enhancements is correct. And then it doesn't say anything about why the government nevertheless decided that $750,000 was actually the appropriate loss amount for the purposes of the sentencing factors. So that's the context that concerns me. Given that statement, why wasn't the government, in this particular situation, obligated to at least explain why it was advocating for a much lower loss amount?
Again, under this court's case law in Lesser, there is no duty of advocacy or explanation on the part of the prosecutor.
Well, if you think about it, it's on a spectrum between standing back and lip service. This feels closer, given the context, to the lip service piece of our jurisprudence than standing back.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, and I would make a comparison between the United States v. Gall and United States v. Canada. For example, this court in Canada found lip service where the government never affirmatively recommended the sentence, never advised the cooperation as was required under the plea agreement terms, and then undermined the agreement by urging a lengthy period of incarceration and to send a strong message. And in contravention, in U.S. v. Gall, the government made substantially similar statements to the case at hand here, and the court found no breach. The court found that the government was dealing with the dual obligation of the adherence to the terms of the plea agreement, and then with the duty to provide relevant information to the sentencing court. And to more address your question with regard to the government's statements, again, the government had no duty to provide any advocacy or explanation. And
that is just an astonishing thought to me, frankly, in context here. I'm curious as to why the government agreed to this plea deal originally. This is astonishingly weak. But you're even under the stipulated guidelines, the guidelines call for prison time. At least a couple of years, right?
Correct.
The government's coming in and says, we recommend probation. Why? Why should the district judge accept that recommendation? Are you entitled to just stay silent? That's not even lip service.
I would respectfully disagree with the lip service point, and I would like to...
Okay, on that point, then, could you address the Eighth Circuit's opinion in U.S. against Brown, which was cited repeatedly in the defense brief, and which you did not cite? It seems to be squarely on point on the facts.
I am not familiar with that decision.
It was discussed extensively in the opening brief.
I apologize, Your Honor. It is out of circuit, so it's not binding on the circuit.
Of course it's not binding, but at the risk of being flip, we owe other circuits at least as much respect as we owe the government's brief.
Again, respectfully, I don't know the specific facts of the case, but I would like to make a point.
Counsel, just to go back, you agree, of course, that the totality of the circumstances is the test that we use to evaluate if there's a breach.
Correct.
So, you know, again, just to ask it more pointedly, you put in a plea agreement that asks for probation, and it's driven by the loss amount, and you say the loss amount is appropriately under the sentencing factor, $750,000. Then the first thing the government says at the sentencing hearing is actually the correct loss amount is much higher than that. Nevertheless, we stand by the agreement and sits down. As Judge Thompson said, looking at the totality of the circumstances, how is that not lip service?
Again, the best is looking at the totality of the circumstances and whether prosecutor's overall conduct was reasonably consistent with making the promise recommendation rather than the reverse. Here, we have to look at the context.
No, because the prosecutor started off, the recommendation is based on the loss amount, and the prosecutor starts off by saying the loss amount is actually much higher. So how is that consistent?
The prosecutor simply clarified to the court that the facts that the probation officer used were correct because Mr. Cortez inferenced that these facts did not support the probation officer's calculation. But then the government went on to state that it was standing by the plea agreement, and it referenced that loss amount specifically when making the statement. That was in line with both what Mr. Cortez agreed that the revocation amount would be, as well as what the calculation was in the plea agreement, and then unequivocally recommended a 24-month sentence. And I would like to also point out that the defendant was in the best position to provide the mitigating factors here, and he did. He specifically stated why the parties had agreed to recommend that sentence, and that's on page 46 of the appendix.
But we're supposed to look at the prosecutor's conduct of counsel.
Also, the prosecutor's statements depend on what the other party has stated. The prosecutor never disagreed with what Mr. Cortez provided on the record.
Frankly, I'm astonished to hear this argument. The weight of arguments in mitigation is so different depending on whether they're coming from the defense or the government. Don't you agree?
And there was the weight of the government behind that recommendation. Indeed, the district court took that recommendation of the parties into account and issued a downwardly varying sentence, even lower than what the agreement had recognized as the total of events level to be, specifically stating that he was making that determination based on the fact that Mr. Cortez had a lesser culpability than his co-defendant. That was specifically what was discussed on the record at the sentencing hearing on page 46 of the appendix.
You don't see a difference in likely weight of mitigation arguments depending on which side is making them?
There may be, Your Honor, but if...
Maybe,
if
yeah.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
At this time, if counsel for the appellant will please reintroduce himself on the record, he has a 2-minute rebuttal.
May it please the court, Anthony Pantovetta is appearing for the appellant. I'd just like to make a few quick points in rebuttal, starting with the government's assertions that this mitigating information was submitted by the defense. I think it's no secret that in the federal criminal justice system, the recommendations of the government carry more weight, especially when describing what shaped their view of the case, the strength of the case, the strength of the government's evidence. And so I don't think that defense counsel could have really fixed anything here. I just want to go back and secondly, talk a little bit about the cases the government cited. This case is nothing like Gaul. The 2016 decision from this court, there in Gaul, yes, it's true that the AUSA said that probation's calculations were correct. However, immediately after, and this is at pages 73 and 74 of the decision, the AUSA recommended a sentence, I believe it was for 87 months. And that was consistent with the party's plea agreement that pegged it to a total offense level and criminal history category. Lassard was decided in plain error, as was Almendinez, which I read to mean that those cases are not binding in this court. And I want to go back to Judge Hamilton's question about Brown. Was Your Honor referring to the 2022 decision of this court or the Fourth Circuit decision?
It's the Eighth Circuit. I was asking the government about the Eighth Circuit. I'm asking you about the First Circuit decision.
I just wanted to...
On there not being a rule of evidence, yes.
I understood. I just want to make clear I understood. And then finally, this was a plea agreement that contemplated a downward variance even before the guideline sentencing range swelled to nearly triple. And so the government, this came as no surprise to the government that the sentence was a downward variance. I believe the original range was for 27 to 33 months. And so there must have been, when negotiating this contract, some understanding that the government would provide the court the raw materials to reach that will only get one sentence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.